podcast day.
Best day of the week.
Best day of the week. What did we get into?
We kicked off talking about International Women's Day and some funding that was announced, different programs out of South Australia and Queensland, and then also looking at some of the investment data that's come out recently on International Women's Day.
Yeah, and a big shout out to the women in our lives that make this all possible. And we'd also then gone back to the prior episode and just talked about what has happened with Host Plus and Employment Hero, because boy, that's escalated quickly with Host Plus calling for the ousting of the CEO, Ben.
Yeah, makes it a really difficult situation for Airtree, who is well and truly caught in the middle of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we talked about the statistics or the probabilities of your startup getting acquired based on different stages. And it peaks at Series B, it turns out.
That is interesting. There was an article out during the week on Dovetail and some of the things happening inside Dovetail around senior people leaving, co-founders leaving, and some churn that's happening. And we gave some perspectives from the outside on that. And another company having some people-related issues is a PwC, and they're doing another cut. And we shared some experiences from previous lives and our suggestion of handling that kind of situation.
And this segued into a discussion on Canva, who just continues to outperform and continues to grow at such a great rate despite the size of the company. And we discussed their oversubscribed secondary sale,
which led into us talking about whether there'll be a Canva cartel equivalent to the PayPal mafia, and we'll see more spin-outs come out of that.
And while the Canva investors and employees and founders are doing well, it is possible to get a big exit and not get anything out of it. And we discussed the $500 million exit from Betfair Paddy Power, and unfortunately, the founders and the staff walked away with almost nothing. So how does that happen? We unpack that.
Then we talk about not just the life of a founder being hard, but also VCs and the statistics around the number of VCs that go on, or rather don't go on, to raise funds 2, 3, and 4.
If Tribe wasn't called Tribe, it'd probably be called Cockroach. So we're going to be cockroaches that last out.
Yeah, this led into a little bit of discussion on why small emerging funds seem to perform the best.
Yeah. Which led into a chat about TVPI, DPI, how we talk about the value of our funds versus what we actually distribute back to investors.
Then we ended with a macro corner where I pulled out charts that I'd found during the week on things around public market valuations, what retail punters are doing with call options, the change in money supply, credit spreads, all sorts of weird and wonderful things that may have zero informational value to you, but I find them interesting.
And then we ended by learning that Jack is sacrificing himself on St. Paddy's Day to spend the weekend with his girlfriend in Melbourne.
Yeah, I look forward to having a Guinness with Anna in Melbourne.
Let's get into it.
Morning.
Morning.
What a morning. We won't go into it, but we're 30 minutes late because I've just been ranting and raving on something. So sorry, lads.
Look, it'll make for a great podcast one day.
Yeah. It depends how quickly you want to destroy our reputations.
What have you been up to?
I don't know about you, but I'm still excited from the little event that we pulled off yesterday. No, Monday.
Monday. That was awesome. I think the rain, for listeners at home, we had an investor event with Vutran at Don's place, which was supposed to be a fireside chat by an actual fireside with the starry night sky. And what was predicted to be a 2% chance of rain turned into...
Other way, 20% chance of rain.
Okay, even better. Anyway, we ended up with just rain all day. But almost everyone still turned up, which was great. I love that they trust us to still provide cover and shelter and all those things. But a really good turnout of investors and founders. And Vu was just, like always, just on fire with the nuggets of wisdom.
So we're going to be releasing that as a podcast episode after it's edited, being an impersonal event. There was some Chatham House rules stuff that we will edit out and keep private for only those that were there. But yeah, really good, really great to connect with people.
Yeah. And for investors listening that would like to come to our next event, we have one with Michael Dempsey at his farm down on the Goldie coming up at the end of April. So we'll share that in the show notes as well.
Not your average farm.
No.
Yeah. So looking forward to that. Jack, you'll definitely have to come for that one.
Yeah. Yep. Jack. Have you booked the flights?
I haven't yet, but I will. I need to book that, book the offsite, and then book London.
Because the thing is, half the people on Monday, Jack, said, where's Jack?
You're the only one at Tribe they want to meet.
Yeah, they're sick of us idiots.
Where's the young guy that knows what he's talking about?
Yeah, he's down in Adelaide.
Speaking of Adelaide, I'm still on a high from South Start.
Yeah, it's been a massive week. Like, we've had, since we last spoke, far out, a lot's happened.
Yeah. And just seeing the social media, everyone feels that vibe post-South start of, wow, that was something epic.
The world is more acknowledging the value of connection to self, connection to others, that money and results isn't ultimately what you're going to look back on your deathbed, although during that journey, it makes life a hell of a lot easier. And they've just got a really great balance of content and knowledge and helping you on that journey and still being able to build that legacy. But this year, they brought in things, whether it's some of the workshops on tech stuff to psychedelics to all sorts of things. It was just a great event.
Yeah, I think that balance of one third content, two thirds social and connection is just what makes South Start so unique. Often you go to these conferences, well, I could have stayed home and just YouTubed that content and you walk away with nothing. But this one, it's really about relationships.
Yeah, we really need to put together a big crew and just hire a plane and take everyone down there. It'll be good.
Let's do it. Hey, Jules, Chief Entrepreneur for Queensland, can we make that happen for next year before you're out of office?
Not putting you on the spot. And Jack, given you're an Adelaidean native, what did you like the most about it?
Just good to catch up and meet new people in the ecosystem. So I suppose we don't have much connection to Melbourne and Sydney investors and founders. Like, we predominantly play in the other states. So it's just good. This is a week that everyone gets together in Adelaide, shares ideas and hear what they're seeing. How about you guys? What was the best part or the best takeaway?
Oh, you mean other than the workshop that Aaron and I did?
Yeah.
I always get surprised and people come up and go, that was really good, actually actionable. It's a call back to my self-esteem issues in younger days that I'm often surprised that people actually like the stuff.
Yeah, people are still reaching out. But for me, it was the Thursday with our session down the rabbit hole where we're just lying on the grass. We're like, what was it, about 50 people?
Yeah. One of the greatest lines that I will never forget, where we're all holding hands, which, let's face it, not exactly the most comfortable thing when you don't know people and you've got to express how you're feeling. And Jack here actually expresses what people are actually thinking when he says uncomfortable but safe. And I think that was just brilliant.
Yeah, but so when we rocked up, I had
We had no idea what we were getting to.
Yeah, we walked into it was already underway.
Yeah, and it wasn't just underway. Like, it was full out there. Introduce yourself with like a bit of a dance. I've walked down by myself, seen that. I've gone, absolutely not. I've had to then go around the corner, try to call my mum back just to kill a bit of time. And then I've come back around. I was like, oh, I feel so awkward and uncomfortable doing this. And then, but overall, it was great. And like, when I said nervous but safe, like, it was true. Like, it was a really good crew of people.
It's the best line, Jack.
So like, it's funny, like, off the back of that session, I probably made the most connections. And it was good. Yeah. We put ourselves out there. There was no bullshit. Like, it was, everyone was having genuine conversations. Everyone dropped the shit. Like, there was no egos. Everyone had their shoes off. And it wasn't just transactional bullshit networking. I'm allergic to that transactional networking.
I don't even know what to say half the time. I'm like,
yeah, I'm not interested. You're not interested. Why are we here? There was no like fake representation of who you are. Everyone was just real.
And then that gave rise to that final event that afternoon at the winery, where it's always good just to have a little bit of a dance, like no one's looking, even though you've got like 500 people looking.
And recording it and sharing it on social media.
So let's jump into some news. Now, let's just recap on something from last week. Last week, we talked about the issue where Employment Hero was having a crack at the submission that Hostplus had done around employment management systems being able to move people between super funds. In the words of Ron Burgundy from Anchorman, that really escalated this week with Hostplus effectively calling for his sacking.
Far out. This has just escalated fast.
I lament, if you think of what we've discussed before, we talk about integration versus disintegration. And in a fixed energy world, 100% is 100%. That's all the time you've got, 24 hours a day. But we do know that in energy, things go to the negative first. Things go to friction. Things go to heat. Things go to destructive conflict. And so if 50% of your energy is getting consumed into destructive conflict stuff, by definition, only 50% of your energy can go elsewhere. Or if it's 80% going into destructive stuff, only 20% can go, whatever that equation is. And what I lament for both parties is that whatever's happening here is just going to be consuming brain space, and that just reduces the energy on both sides for them to go out and achieve what they need to achieve for their customers and themselves. What I'm hoping they can do is find a way to reintegrate, given that indirectly they're a shareholder and clearly there's some conflict of interests here. When there's a conflict of interest between different parties, that's where conflict really escalates. Then it really turns to shit. This isn't good for the ecosystem.
No, and what you said, yeah. Don, there's a conflict here, particularly for Airtree. So they've backed the founder of Employment Hero, but then they also take funds, institutional funds from Hostplus. So like,
I would not want to be them right now.
No way. Like they are directly in the middle, and which regardless of which way they side with, there's going to be like upside, downside. It's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. And like you said, we don't have all the information, and it's hard to sit on the sidelines and take a judgment when you don't have it.
Airtree is almost, I think, a little bit losing the situation. So if they back one, they'll lose the other. If they play Switzerland and say, we're staying out of it, they'll probably at least annoy both. So I just hope they can find a way to bridge this, because yeah, I just don't think it's helpful for the ecosystem.
Yeah.
So that's just closing the loop on that. Then following our last podcast after South Start, it was International Women's Day.
Yeah, it was good to see some announcements that came out. They announced, the South Australian government announced that they have a new program providing grants for female founders through the Fearless Females Network that's over there. So that'll be open up for applications in June and then allocating funds in November. And the president of that, Paula Turbull, said that it's really designed to help close that funding gap for female founders. So if you're an SA female founder, definitely check that one out. And then the other thing that came out on Friday was the Queensland government have tweaked two of the female founder programs that they run. So one in particular is the Female Founders Co-Investment Fund, which I can't remember, Don, if we've talked about this before, but it copped a lot of criticism because it's been going for a while, but it had actually only funded one venture.
Yeah, and there was another female founders program, I think, out of Melbourne as well, that just got crucified just given how much they fucked them around.
Yeah, so I was part of the consultation piece on how to improve it. And the good thing is that they have improved it. So now female founders no longer need to have been 100% owning the company when it launched, which was just an insane criteria. And they don't yet have to have an investor when they apply for the funding, which is good, because otherwise the bar was just too high and it was already benefiting those that had made it through the funding gap, so to speak. And the third key criteria that changed is now international investors qualify as an eligible investor. So good to see the Queensland government adjusting that program, making it more accessible.
I'm an investor and on the board of a company called Pucto that has two female founders, Crystal and Belinda. And when that program came out, there was a lot of excitement because they were absolute shoo-in. They did the work. We then tried to look at how we would get the co-investment with the other investors, but it's a little bit difficult because it's like a chicken and the egg thing. And it was, that program was a disaster for them because they kept almost being drip-fed news. Were they, weren't they? It's inevitable that you end up putting a lot of hope to get it, so your plans change. And I think the first rollout was catastrophically bad for female founders, and hopefully they can learn from it and improve it, like you say.
Yeah, it was really bad. I remember they had hundreds of applicants to fund one. And when you saw the criteria, it was just biased towards those. Like anything, government has a bit of a history of trying to de-risk programs by backing those that are already winning. But yeah, hopefully these changes are going to make it more accessible.
This is where I'm all mature and don't mention like giving government money to $1 billion fund. No, anyway, there'll be a lot of editing in this episode. And I think it's broadly, as we saw through the Cut Through Ventures report, that there's still a long way to go on female funding.
Yeah. The last Cut Through Ventures report for 23 showed that funding or participation in deals for all female or mixed gendered teams was up, like a 5-year high, but still massive gaps, right? So still a lot to be done.
Yeah. And what was also released post International Women's Day was the work that Elaine Stead from Human VC has done in pulling together a range of code of conducts and like resources to help the ecosystem with some issues, especially around sexual harassment and those issues that live often below the surface that a lot of people sometimes don't believe or don't want to believe exist, but they can be there. And we contributed to that, but a lot of other people did as well. And I think it's a positive tool that I'd recommend people find and look out for. And that momentum just in the ecosystem with things like Grapevine as well, you know, how do we play a positive role? How do we shine a light on things? How do we get behavioral change? How do we get consequence change? And part of it is giving tools to help teams manage these things.
Yeah, I'd encourage everyone to have a read. Well done to Loney for pulling that together. The bit for me is the fact that it goes beyond just templates. Like it actually talks about some cultural issues. It has some really good content that I think will be enlightening for some readers, whether you're an investor or not. If you're in the ecosystem, you're working with startups in any way, absolutely read through this document because it's really an incredible resource.
That then dovetails in some other data that was coming out of the US, and Australia sometimes lags the US, but there is, I think, PitchBook put out that there was a record of VC dollars for female founders in the US. So maybe that's some momentum that'll continue here.
Yeah, so PitchBook released this on International Women's Day, showing that female founders and co-founders secured 27 or pretty much 28% of total deal value last year. If you take out OpenAI with their raise, it drops to 20, just short of 23%. But a record high allocation of VC capital flowing to at least female co-founded ventures, which is positive. Obviously, still a big gap. The other interesting stat that was in there was at a GP level. So the share of female check writers at the largest VC firms grew slightly to 17%. So still a long way to go in terms of female participation within VCs themselves.
And then some other data came out from Europe, and Europe's well behind as well.
Yeah, totally. So in 2023, startup founded or co-founded by women, so startups that were co-founded by women in Europe raised $5.9 billion in venture capital, which is just less than 10% of total venture capital raised in 23. But yeah, it has doubled in the last decade, which was, yes, but far out, there's still a massive long way to go. And it's plateaued around the 10% mark since 2017 in Europe as well.
Yeah. Now, we were going to an Innovation Bay lunch today, but as I've got three sick children and a shitty immune system, I'm going to skip that. But one of the conversation points that you're going to be there with is around that disparity of funding. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Yeah, it should be a good chat. These events are always awesome. And shout out to Innovation Bay. And I love the fact that they pulled together these little talking points for us. But yeah, we'll be interesting to come see what comes out of that. And I'll close the loop on next week's potty in terms of what we discuss.
Yeah. Now, whether it's a male team, female team, combination, all types, interesting little chart that came out during the week was, what is the likelihood that your startup will get acquired? And so it was the percentages of startups. So this is US data, but from 2023 out of 37,000 cap tables. So that's not a small data set. So that's pretty good. If you're building with the thought to sell it, 0.7% of companies get sold at pre-seed, 1.7% at seed, 2.5% at Series A, 3.1% at Series B, 2.6% at Series C, and then 2.2% at Series D.
I didn't expect that to peak at Series B. I hadn't thought of that before. But that's
I thought it would get the higher percentage, the bigger it gets. But anyway, it probably makes sense because Series C, Series D is probably expensive as shit. I don't know.
Yeah. And this is M&A transactions. So it's ignoring IPO data. So it's interesting. It'd be interesting to correlate the two, though, to see if those that go past Series B end up listing. I'm not sure. But interesting stats.
I think anybody that I've met that built a company specifically to create wealth and sell never ended up creating wealth and selling it because the orientation of why they were doing it was wrong. Yeah. People that intimately believe in a problem or a product and just head down and that the money was the secondary order thing, they're the ones that win.
So true.
Money by itself runs out of being a motivator at a certain point. So another bit of news this week that's come out is that Dovetail, so Dovetail was one of the 2021 vintage holy moly unicorn raises. They raised, I think, $89 million at a close to $1 billion valuation. An article by Jessica Sears come out from the AFR. Several senior engineers who helped build the research software startup have quit in the last few weeks. And then in February, one of the co-founders resigned as well. Now, the co-founder that's still there, CEO, Benjamin Humphrey, he declined to answer specific questions, but said that the staff turnover at a 95-person company was not above and beyond what was considered normal or healthy for a startup of our size. What the article also talked about is that Dovetail has a churn problem, it believes. Its customer research software has frequently become a casualty of cost-cutting programs in the end-user organizations. Hardware retailer Bunnings dropped the product several months ago, as did consulting giant Deloitte. Nine Entertainment, the publisher of The Australian, also wound back its Dovetail subscription. Now, Benjamin Humphrey again said that Dovetail was not experiencing an increase in churn above what's normal. So there's a couple of things that I'd like to unpack there. But any initial reaction from you guys?
No, other than the caveat of obviously we don't have full insight in what's going on, but I think there are some good things to unpack here.
The word normal, I think, is an interesting one in that for high growth early stage companies, turnover is normal. And actually, you peel back the covers of what looks like oiled machines, and behind the scenes, at best, it's a duck trying to be calm on the surface, but its little legs paddling like shit underneath. But it's where the turnover is that sometimes can become abnormal. And when long-term staff, right, people that were there and even at co-founder level, when that starts to happen, nobody should think that's normal. It's certainly not desired, because one of the things we keep talking about on this podcast is the idea of trust and respect. And companies that have deep trust and respect, people can take conflict and make it constructive rather than destructive. But when conflict turns destructive, right, when trust is lost, when respect is lost, things turn to shit. Now, trust is an outcome of other ingredients where you have common vision and mission, right? When you have common values and behaviors, and when you have structures that are functional for that, that's when you can maintain trust and respect disappears. If vision changes, if mission changes, if values turn out to be different, if behaviors are different, like that's when it turns to rubbish. And so for here, if we're in an investor and advisory capacity, I'd be trying to get the team to just analyze that. If we are getting staff turnover at that senior long-term level, don't try and consider it normal unless you've really unpacked that whole trust and respect ingredient piece. If people are just leaving because vision has changed, I now want to go and do something else, or this wasn't what I thought, that's probably okay. And in an admission phase, but where values and that stuff starts to come in, and if I had to bet the churn that they're calling normal, I would submit big brands like that discontinuing your product, I just personally wouldn't want to call that normal. And what happens is then when an issue like that comes up, what happens is the solution to it, the direction to take, there can be a range of different directions. There can be a range of different solutions, right? And so what happens is the world becomes uncertain. Different people have different views, different styles, different things. And that's where that conflict can come destructive. Now, the manifestation is people leaving. The causality actually is a little bit deeper. And I think go beyond this article and just look a little bit deeper. Where, for people to leave, where has trust and respect broken down? And often it's broken down in response to something uncertain that we've got to try and resolve. And a big issue is when you're not achieving your results. Now, one of the things coming back to what Vu said at our session on Monday is that they seem to, a bit like what Luke and Nia had said, where they had been offered $500 million at a $5 billion valuation and they turned it down because they weren't ready for that level of expectation. They hadn't ironed out all of those things. And Vu said similar, that they tried to not get sucked into valuations that they didn't believe that they could grow into. Now, I don't know this for sure, but what I do know is that if you've raised at a $1 billion valuation and you've taken some money off the table in a secondary, and then you start to churn high profile logos, I'd be willing to bet there's some conflict that has come up in there. And I really just want founders to not try and look at the specific outcome, go to the core ingredients and teams that can build trust and respect and maintain it during difficult times. there's just they're the ones that tend to win. Have you got a different view on that?
No, I agree. I think there's a good lesson in there for founders that might just look at their churn percentage, like the stat, the metric, and they might say, this is consistent and normal and it's staying level, but actually unpacking who is churning, looking deeper at the causality, the why, and the value of those logos that are churning. Like, I think seeing the names here, external view, okay, that's a bit of an alarm bell. I'd be wanting to look at what's really happening there.
In early stage business, there's always shit that happens that cause alarm bells.
Yeah.
And then what happens is teams of people have to work together to solve those issues. The problem is teams of people are connected and integrated depending on their level of trust and respect. And that trust and respect is like that glue. And so having to react to those things, this is where it seems the wheels seem to fall off.
Yeah. And Vu made another good comment on Monday night. He was talking about some of the enterprise clients who were ticking over on subscription, but they weren't active users. And he talked about it as a time bomb and in wanting to get rid of them because otherwise they will eventually churn and it can be this catastrophic moment. So getting rid of them early and actually saying, you know what, if you're not getting value, leave. And that can be a bit counterintuitive for founders that just look at the revenue side. There's all like gyms, there can be a thing of, I want my members to sign up and never come in and use the gym. That's the ideal scenario. It's actually no. If they're not getting value, they're probably also not providing testimonials to others. It's diminishing the value of your product in the market. And it could become a time bomb. As soon as budgets tighten, you'll be the first thing that gets cut. So it can come to bite you in the ass later.
And it's a reminder that valuation or number of staff or number of revenue has almost no relevance to the life cycle. As we've discussed before, early stage companies, analogous to young humans, high flexibility, but they don't yet have the controls, the systems, the process, the predictability, all of those. And so when you try and grow too fast and growth is what you're trying to achieve, that's a big difference to healthy development. And so what we try and do with our portfolio is not look at how fast can we grow or how much money can you absorb. Is what is the fastest rate that we can develop in a healthy manner? Because if you can develop in a healthy manner, then growth is likely to be one of those outcomes, but it's likely to be healthy growth. Now, I'm not saying that isn't occurring here. We don't have all the facts. But having seen this movie before, there is a predictability to the life cycle. And yes, it is normal in early stage companies because it's just a difficult environment, but it's normal in some areas, abnormal in others. And what I would just put forward to investors and founders that are listening, the churn and the staff turnover is a manifestation. It's an outcome of other ingredients. Look internally, where is trust and respect falling down? What are the ingredients that is falling down in, and how do I help these people through it? And whilst this next company, PwC, isn't a tech company, there's a similar thing with staff churn, but churn is like it's more proactive. It's redundancies. But Paul Smith and Edmund Tadros just put out an article talking about another big set of redundancies happening in that professional services firm. Because what happens is when people leave, either because of people for their own reasons or are made redundant, in companies, there's a cultural effect. And what then starts to happen is the culture gets diminished, which then sees more people leave, which then sees revenue loss, which then sees need for more cost cutting, which then sees more people leave. Like it's this spiral. Mm. And unfortunately, one of the companies that I had to put into liquidation that I purchased a company thinking that I could just turn it around with a few different things. But then we ended up in this cost-cutting cycle to zero because we lost good people, lost good revenue, have to cut costs in professional services. And it's not just PwC, it's happening everywhere, but this article is PwC. It's just a problem.
Don, yeah. Just to pull it back to a takeaway for founders, from your experience, you've said like you only want to do one cut and you do that early. Is that right?
For a start, don't grow unhealthy. Don't get yourself into a position where you may have to cut people, right? That's step number one, if you can help it. Now, sometimes the world changes, you lose a contract, you got no choice. But if you are going to go down this path, cut once, cut hard.
And is it cut early or like when?
Cut early, cut hard, cut once. Try and get rid of that pain as fast as possible. For all of the shit that I throw at Elon's way, he did demonstrate, now I think he handled it in some areas a bit poorly, a lot of companies are a hell of especially in that growth phase that have been reliant on external capital, have been bloated. But what you don't want in a culture is death by a thousand cuts. Oh, let's just cut a bit here. Oh, we're going to have to do it again. Oh, we're going to have to do it again. Because then it makes people uncertain. What does uncertainty lead to, like we've just been talking, right? It leads to conflict. It leads to fear. And the best people, they just leave by themselves. They go, fuck it, I'm going to go take another job. And then the rest, and then if you think of internal integration, disintegration, the culture disintegrates. All this energy goes into this internal, is there going to be another cut? Am I going to be on it? I don't agree with what they did last time. All of this. And so there's no energy left for the customer, right? And sales go down. And then we've got to be careful with staff are often the easiest thing to cut. And it's like the old consulting joke. I'll pick on McKinsey here. It's like you go to McKinsey to lose weight and they say, got it. We're going to cut off a leg. So they cut off your leg and you stand on the scales and you've lost weight. I've got one leg. I don't have my health. I can't run anywhere. I can't go and do a whole lot of things. I've got one fucking leg. And that's too often what happens is the metrics that we're trying to achieve lead to some outcomes. So again, just be very careful.
And I think there's going to be more to come here because it is across the top four consulting in that space. And I know a couple inside that are saying they've got half the budget, operational budget they had last year. So it's not just headcount, but operational activity is down. And so they are now talking about how disenfranchised they are. They're just like, I want to get out. Where can we go? So
it's a spiral.
It's a spiral, absolutely.
On Google, you can still go and find it. Luckily, as time goes on, it's now page 2 or 3. Don McKenzie admits strategic mistakes in liquidation. And it's true. I got too lucky too young. I bought two companies. One company paid, I think, $250,000 in cash, took over $300,000 in debt, and it produced $30 million in cash profits over the next 5 years, thanks to some good timing, some good luck, and a few other bits and pieces. But then this thing that at the time that I bought it was doing, I don't know, 40 something in revenue, had to put into liquidation a couple of years later because I just didn't understand those things.
Yeah.
And yeah, the problem with turnarounds is that they're hard to turn. And coming back to Dovetail, if you concentrate on a culture of trust and respect and put that in the center and work out what are the ingredients for trust and respect, and the same for PwC, if you put those ingredients in the center, that's your ticket to the ball game. Concentrate on those ingredients and then the manifestation will hopefully change. But if you're just concentrating on those external things, you're going to be dead in the water. And I'll bet anything that if they don't do that, we'll be seeing more cuts.
And going back to your question, Jack, like the lesson for founders, there's also a lesson here for VCs. Like we've seen this exact thing play out in the VC landscape. VC firms put on massive headcounts during 21 and afterwards in the glory days of raising and deploying capital. And this year we're already seeing, like this was a big topic actually of little side conversations at Southstar. We're seeing VC funds laying off staff. They're doing it quietly. But suddenly the latest hires into different funds are now working at startups or leaving and going into different sectors. So that boom time, massive scale up of resources now being cut back. It'll be interesting. Again, like we've talked about last episode, there's going to be fewer people working in VC end of this year than started.
Yeah. And there's a couple of articles towards the end of this run sheet that will question our sanity, but we'll get to that at that point. But someone that's not suffering from any of these things, that Cliff from Canva was at the AFR summit or whatever it's called and said that its revenue is growing at 60%.
That's phenomenal. At that stage of the life cycle, still growing 60%.
Just a machine. And that for the $1.5 billion that they're seeking to sell in secondaries, they've got over $2.2 billion of interest in that. And a question was asked, are they keeping the valuation for the secondary low at the moment so then they can have a big pop at IPO? To which he said, I think we're going to pop anyway because we're growing at 60%, so our growth is accelerating. And look, to be accelerating at that scale is really impressive.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Another bit from the article, Cliff, who is known to handle funding rounds personally, laughed off suggestions that they were trying to keep it low. Again, coming back to some of that life cycle stuff, something the size of Canva is still quite early in its life cycle and still is controlled well and truly by its founders. And so to have Cliff still running and controlling that is totally normal. And any view that Camp is late stage and got all of its systems and process and controls and decentralization and proper management structures and all of that stuff, no chance. It's still a young, high growth individual.
Yeah. And the other interesting part was what they're working on, building out their AI tools and also proving out their enterprise side of the business.
Yeah, I think it's interesting going from that PLG, almost consumer stuff, into enterprise. That can be a difficult transition sometimes, but they've got resources, I guess, to try and make it work.
And I think they've earned the right, like what we're saying. They proved out and they've really grown and have the optionality now to test other channels and avenues.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a lot of other companies, success leaves clues. They started really tight with a product for a certain part of the market that wasn't as sophisticated. They've grown and they've owned that part and now they're going to start going wider. It's just that common playbook, which is the opposite of a lot of entrepreneurial energy that says, we can do all these things.
Yeah.
But it's like that saying, you can have everything you want in life, just not all at the same time. And building a high growth company that's sustainable, you can't do everything at once. And early on, you've got to be incredibly tight.
There was a good Peter Wagner's episode on 20VC. I was listening to that this morning. And he made a good analogy. Startups that pitch this layering of different features that they'll add in the future. And if that's critical to your success, then I'm out, because it's hard enough just to get one thing. You're lying there, Jack, like they've earned the right to now go and experiment and add these other layers. But they went niche and nailed it before doing that. And it's a great lesson for founders.
Now, some other interrelated aspect that in Capital Brief, Dan Van Boom put together an article asking the question, will the Canva cartel appear, which is a play on the PayPal mafia. And he writes that Canva's secondary sale and eventual IPO will enrich its early backers and likely usher a new generation of Australian founders. Many in the space are optimistic that minted alumni will turn into the Canva cartel, the equivalent of America's PayPal mafia. After the payments platform was bought by eBay in 2001 for $1.5 billion, many of its executives went on to become world-beating founders. Elon Musk, Peter Thiel are the most famous, but by no means the only high achievers. The PayPal mafioso include the founders of YouTube, LinkedIn, Yelp. A PayPal capital fund created by Peter Thiel and several PayPal lieutenants were then early investors in Airbnb and Facebook. I'm hoping it does.
Oh, yeah. And this has been proven out. The Kauffman Foundation did studies on this. Even for smaller size companies that exit, that recycling of not just the founders and investors, but also the early employees that have upskilled through that.
Blackbird really had a big chunk from the Atlassian boys, to the point that the Atlassian boys were effectively, my understanding, I could be wrong, they were effectively part of the investment committee that said yes or no to things in very early Blackbird phase, and that money came from Atlassian.
Yeah, and we're seeing it. How many pitches, Jack, have we seen of Technology One senior staff now cycling through as founders? Like, I really hope, I believe this will play true. Like, this will happen.
Yeah, I don't even think, like, we need to even read a study to realize that if you are in a high performing team and you're at 0 to 1 and then become a category winner, you're going to be able to apply those principles and take them away and start your own company. Like, it's only going to have a net positive on our ecosystem that's emerging.
And people that found their way into early stage unicorns are builders anyway, generally, and they like the noise, they like the mess. The people that don't survive that, they're a different breed, but the people that do survive that have it in their DNA of that phase of the life cycle. Now, while a big chunk of the Canberra employees and obviously the founders are doing very well, not just from a total exit, just in the secondary sales, did you see that article that looked at how Paddy Power Betfair was acquired for $465 million, yet the founders and employees earned almost nothing? So they sold the business for nearly $500 million and the founders and employees got nothing.
Chuck, well, I have a traumatic response to reading this. Like, my exit, which was tiny and insignificant to this one, and I walked away with an ATO debt. And my wife was just like, what the hell just happened after 9 years? So I did have a bit of a trauma response. But yeah, look, this isn't the first time I've heard this play out, even at the big end of the deal transaction size. And in this case, it was the liquidity preference that came back to take a big chunk of the capital.
for founders that haven't gone to this stage, if I put in $100, a normal investment, it's just whatever comes back is in pro rata what I'm entitled to. But if I've got a 2x preference, the first $200 have to come to me. If I've got a 3x preference, the first $300 have to come to me. And this, in this instance, it looks like they had a 3x pref on the last round. Now, how do liquidity preferences come about? They come about generally when things aren't going well and the founders don't want to take a hit on the valuation. And sometimes it's the investors that don't want to take a hit on the valuation as well. Mm. That you got to go back to your investment committee or whatever else. So a deal is struck to say, this $100 million val feels really expensive, but I'll give it to you on the basis that my investment going in has a liquidation preference. And then if it continues not to go, the problem is at an exit, the only people getting money are the investors. Now, some people will say that is taking advantage of the founders. Some people will say that's the reality of capital markets. If they didn't want the liquidity preference, what were the terms without the liquidity preference? And those terms normally are highly dilutive. Now, highly dilutive situation at the point of exit is still better if you haven't hit your numbers, because then you're at least getting a percentage of something. Liquidity preferences, there is a chance that you get nothing. The problem with the entrepreneurial mind is that it's always going to work it out. We'll always solve it. If I can just live another day, I'll fix this thing. And sometimes you can't.
It's so true. We saw a lot of this early last year in kind of that down round vintage post 2021 valuations, the use of liquidity preference and also options and warrants. And yeah, that the founders would rather avoid the extra dilution on the belief. Again, the reality distortion field of a founder. We're going to make it work. We're going to have an amazing exit.
I would never. We have done a liquidity preference on the core money. I would never do a 3x. Like,
yeah,
it is important that we are all in the same canoe and we all need to take a bit of a haircut. If the founder wants to try and maintain it, I would go to a level of liquidity pref, but not this.
No. Yeah, the problem there, Don, is that creates misalignment. And as a VC, we're not in this game trying to make a return on capital on the basis of an unsuccessful exit. We're trying to make an outlier return on a really successful exit. And that's where a liquidity preference comes in. Like, really, it gives us downside protection, but then it keeps us the option to convert to common stock if it's a successful outcome. And then we get no limit on our upside. The 3x is just ridiculous and creates total misalignment.
Yeah. And if you're protecting that much for the downside, like, there's something inherently flawed, right?
Yeah, you're in it for the wrong reason. Like, you're trying to get a 3x on an unsuccessful outcome.
Yeah.
So as part of my liquidation, let's all get into the trauma response. I look forward to yours one day, Jack. But I didn't do a liquidity preference. I guaranteed debt and guaranteed money coming in using listed scrip, and then all of that got taken.
I created the model. I just briefly did the model off the back of listening to a podcast of how to understand liquidity preferences. And I shared this with Aaron a while ago. If there's interest, I can share my screen now.
Yeah, throw it up.
I just thought it'd be worthwhile because I didn't understand liquidation preferences until I saw a basic model of how it plays out. And really what you need to understand is a liquidation preference provides the downside protection for a VC in the event that it's an unsuccessful outcome. We have the option to convert to common stock if there's more upside and get a better return. To explain this to listeners here, if we're a seed investor and we put in $500,000 at a post money of $5 million, we have 10% ownership of the company. And if we then sell the company for that price, like, we're still getting a 1x return on our capital. And where liquidation preferences are important are when it's sold for less than the valuation that we got in at. So if we sell for $2.5 million and we have a 1x liquidation preference, we get our money back, regardless of the 10%
shareholding. Yep.
Whereas if we converted to common stock in this situation, we would get 250K. And as we can see, like, a 2x liquidation preference there, if we sell for 2.5, we still get $1 million of that, despite if we converted to common stock, it would only be 250K. So it's really important to model this out and understand as a founder what the outcome is going to be.
That's great advice. My preference in this market, in this day and age, is agree the price, take the medicine, get the deal done. But there are situations where some form of liquidation preference works for both parties.
Yeah.
But just understand the consequence, but just for fuck's sake, don't do it three times. Whatever's happening inside your company, it's not worth a three times, because if you're at that position in order to get it done, you need a three times liquidation pref. Whatever hole you're in, whatever challenge you've got, it sounds like a really fucking big hill to climb.
Yeah.
What I don't understand, like, this isn't a small transaction. Like, I'm very surprised that there wasn't any advisory on the founder's side to realize that the capital they had taken on with a 3x liquidation was going to cause them to get hardly any return.
I don't know this for sure, but we're talking about a betting company. I bet you we're talking about a gambling crew of people that like to roll the dice.
Yeah.
It's probably unfair, but someone rolled the dice and you could afford good advice at that level.
Yeah. And it could have been a binary outcome where it was that or nothing.
Yeah. But like,
not
normally,
what was going on.
So normally it's, as a VC, we can only appoint the right to have the company valued to be acquired, right? So it's ultimately up to the founder, CEO, to sell the company. You'd never sell it if you know you're not going to get a return. You have to then go back to the VC, have a cut on the liquidation preference so you can actually have some upside. I'm just surprised that $500 million transaction and this outcome happened.
Yep.
A world full of surprises.
It's a good segue, Jack, that point of just how hard it is to be a founder. Even when things go well and you have your exit, it can still bite you in the butt. But equally, like we know, being an investor, it can also be bloody hard as well. And there was some interesting data shared via LinkedIn about the statistics on funds, early stage fund managers that make it through to raise future funds. So fund two, fund three, fund four. And a bit of a caveat, this data is looking at 5 to 2020, but it showed that only 17% of VC funds make it through to raising fund four.
Yeah, and only 51% get a chance to have fund two.
Which it's, I find it interesting. I think this stat, like my view, is that this is going to get worse. But then again, on that podcast I was listening to this morning, the 20 VC, Peter Wagner made this point, and he's been in VC since 96. And his point was VCs don't get penalized when they make the same mistake that all the others made. You get penalized for making a mistake that no one else makes. And it did make me think about that 21 vintage when everyone deployed capital. Were they all making the same mistake?
I think if your third, fourth, fifth fund that's made the same mistake as all of those, I think that's one set of rules. Mm. If you were the first fund and you made that mistake and therefore you don't have the other history of the other funds that those other ones will have, I think you're fucked.
100%.
Yeah.
Because you don't have any bias for deal flow. If you've proven five funds back to back, you've clearly got an edge and you've proved to LPs that you can get a return. If 2021, you get a bit silly with everyone else because everyone else drove valuations up, therefore you were losing in on the deals, you're going to get a second chance, more likely to get a second chance compared to someone, an emerging manager, who's going out for the first time.
Yeah.
That's my gut feel. But what keeps coming up is data that at a certain level of success, when a fund gets too big, their returns drop. Their absolute dollars may get bigger, but their returns drop. And the smaller funds constantly outperform on an IRR basis the bigger funds. Tribe Global Ventures.
yeah. And by smallest funds, so this data, they were talking about fund size up to 30 million, they define as the smallest scale. And they perform a full quartile better than the largest end of the scale.
Yeah. And I think we're seeing, it's clear, I think on some of our portfolio, there we are looking at things that the bigger ones just can't look at because it doesn't make sense. We're bringing some expertise and some interconnected relationships that I genuinely know and can see changing the trajectory of their growth. Like I can see why.
And it reminded me, I looked up a Buffett quote because I remember Warren Buffett making this point so many times. And he had this great quote, "Anyone who says the size, which is of the fund, does not hurt investment performance is selling you. The highest rates of return I've ever achieved were when I was investing peanuts. It's a huge structural advantage not to have a lot of money."
Yeah. Yeah. He said that in the latest Berkshire Hathaway shareholder letter. He said the same thing. They're just too big now to realistically consistently outperform the market. But hopefully they've got more protection compared to the market.
Yeah.
But even like looking at where we sit in the market, we're like micro cap and the bigger funds, they can't afford. It's not worth their time to play in the space we're playing. And despite that, like for us, like a small check under 500K, which we can prove out a thesis without risking too much capital and reputation, and then really be the front runner to provide follow-on capital to grow the companies, is where we're playing.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, what I would find interesting is how are those returns calculated? And I saw a funny post that Matt Allen of Tractor had put up. He said, as seen on a reply to Rain Ong, aka Ryan Wong, in a thread by Terence Tam, that TVPI actually means theoretical value, possibly imagined.
I love it. That is so good. For those who might not be familiar with it, DPI is looking at the actual capital return, whereas TVPI is the paper value, which in our sector, look, most of the funds, they're sitting on nice valuations on paper, but yet to return capital. But it is like we're seeing that cycle now, right? We've talked about this on previous episodes where capital is starting to be returned to the market.
Yeah, it absolutely is. That's a whole lot of the news items. Any other reflections on those before we get into a little bit of some market charts?
Other than to say there's never a shortage of things happening and news to talk about and unpack for founders and investors.
Yeah. So we've had some feedback that doing a few broader macro charts is interesting and helpful. So I've been just saving and collecting a few, as you guys have as well. Can you see my screen? So for listeners at home, here's a chart that goes all the way back to 1925. And what it shows is the market cap of the largest stock relative to the 75th percentile stock. And as you can see, just before big crashes, 1932, 1964, 73, 2000, 2009, the little 2020 blip, and now again, 2023, you can see that the median is around, what would you say, guys, 300 to 400? That's where the middle is. Where it's low is like 1 to 200 times, but just before shit happening, it's close to 800 times, and we're at about 750. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't continue. A body in motion continues in motion. I just think this is an interesting little chart. And on the chart there, it's got where that data comes from. So that's one set. The doomsdayers would all say, sell, it's too expensive. But what we do know is expensive gets more expensive and cheap gets cheaper, right? That's what tends to happen. Now, another chart, the percentage of current S&P 500 members that are outperforming the SPY, so the S&P 500 ETF over the prior 1 year period. So this is saying, what's the percentage of companies that are all hitting it out of the park from a share price point of view? And it's down at 24%. Now at peaks, it's more like 80%, 71, 68, 64, 63, 57. And then at the troughs, it's like 50, 47, 47, 45, 41, 34. But we're down at a trough. Now, when was the last time it was down at this level? June 1999. And the majority of returns in that last big tech boom was like through 99, early, very early 2000. Mm. So a chart like this says, actually, if it's like that, we're only just at the beginning of rocking and rolling. Now, what's been interesting, and interrupt me at any point to jump in and have a chat. If you recall the meme stock phase of COVID, where retail buyers just started to go crazy buying options and then they disappeared. In the beginning of 24, retail is back, baby. It is buying call options at a rapid rate. And the chart that we're looking at here is from 2019. It was at quite a low level. And then as COVID came, it went up, what, close to 10 times? Maybe even more at the peak. Then it died in the tech crash that we had from 2022. And then people really started to put options. And then they died as well last year. It's like pretty low. But now retail, it's back, baby. And it's just buying call options hand over fist. So when you've got call options being bought, what happens is that tends to drive the market up because the sellers of those call options to hedge their position have to at least go and buy some stock. And there was some analysis on Tesla showing, they call it, I think, the gamma pool. I could get that wrong, but effectively, if you're selling an option, and an option is the right but not the obligation to buy 100 shares at a certain price, the way these dealers go and hedge it is they will go and buy at least a few shares and then take an option on the other side. And so just that action often just drives up the share price. But also what's happening is we saw post-COVID, so the chart that I've now got is the change in the money supply. And normally that going back to 1960, it goes up to 8.2%, down to 2.2%, up to 13%, down to 5%. There's this little band. But then in COVID, with everything that happened, it goes from 3.2% to 26% in just a very short period of time. Then interest rates rise, things get cut, the money supply goes negative, huge contraction. But although it's still negative at the moment, its a rate of change is increasing. It's going from negative 4.5 to 2. So there's actually there's a positive rate of change there. So if you've got a whole lot of things of options and money supply is now improving, these are the kinds of things that give wave to big price appreciation. So anybody that's too negative, that things are too expensive, there's some macro stuff there saying that otherwise. And then this is a little table that shows how many all-time highs were achieved in a year. And it goes all the way back down to 1929. Now, 1929, just before the Great Depression or whatever, had 45 highs in that year. And then the stock market didn't make another high until 1953, 23 years. But then once it did make a high in 1954, 27 new highs that year. Then 49 new highs in 1955. Then 14 new highs in 1956. Then there was obviously a down. But you can see once, on average, once a market starts making some new highs, tell me what you think here, boys, but there's an average of in like the 20s and the 30s, although there are some years with the 20. Like in 2017, it had 62 new highs. Then 2018, 19 new highs. 2019, 36 new highs. 2020, 33 new highs. 2021, 70 new highs. Now, last year, we had no new highs, but this year, we're at 15 so far. If history is anything to go by, we're probably going to have more highs. And if this is the beginning of a new bull run, we may have multiple years with new highs. So people like me that can get a bit too negative, you got to be careful.
It is interesting when you look at the data, like that, look at the run from 2013 to 22 and now 24 back up.
So like I think in a world of AI, and maybe NVIDIA can grow into it. Maybe all AI is this next boom, and maybe a multi-trillion dollar valuation is just the new norm.
Maybe.
Then, as I said in a previous episode, you know things are about to maybe get a little bit interesting when credit spreads start to spike. We're back at historical lows. The bond market ain't seeing any problems at the moment. It's not sending any warning signs out. And people like me who have called out, hey, what's going to happen with interest rates raising? This is out of the US, this chart, but real personal income, inflation adjusted, is up for the ninth consecutive new high. It's up another 2.9%. So income is certainly increasing, and that's obviously offsetting a whole lot of bits. But this is out of UK, total new company insolvencies. So for people listening at home, anytime you, because we don't know a recession's occurred until we look backwards, what tends to happen is the end of a recession gets marked by us, or the end or the beginning gets marked by a spike in insolvencies. Now that didn't happen in COVID, and we know why, because every government bailed everyone out.
Yeah.
But now insolvencies are pretty well at a record high not seen since 2008, and that was only slightly eclipsed in 1992.
I saw similar data in Australia too. Like, is that just pent up, like because everyone was propped up and bailed out?
Could be. I'm just a charts man, right? I'm just
going. Yeah, there's some interesting stuff in here. I mean, hearing that I should be hedging my call options is like just that alone.
They're just a few charts. My gut feel is we haven't seen anything yet. We're in the early innings of an AI boom, and until things are like crazy and Uber drivers are making billions in NVIDIA stock like they were with Tesla, and it just doesn't feel like there's so much exuberance around.
Yeah. I think the real personal income one surprised me out of those charts. I just gut feel like, I wasn't expecting it to actually be up and at a highest level.
I think that's because our personal income is all down.
I was going to say, I've got to talk with the boss.
Jack, the capital raise is almost done. We're almost there.
Actually, while we've been on this call, all the shareholders have signed our shareholders' resolution. So cap raise is all guns blazing.
Thank you, shareholders. So we'll be getting that finalized. And Jack, I think, are you happy to be paid in Bitcoin?
No, that's too expensive at the moment.
Okay, meme coin. Let's find what meme.
I don't, just because your love of Elon.
I think we need to make a VC coin.
Yeah. Like just.
Yeah. Ironic incompetent, we'll call out. Yeah, so that's the news, and there's a few charts. Any other call outs on those charts? Jack, anything that stands out for you?
No, nothing. That was good, Don. Thank you.
It's just, there's always conflicting. One chart will say, oh, and then another chart will say something different. And yeah, the thing in markets is you've got to be contrarian and right, and you've got to get your timing right too, because being early to something is indistinguishable from being wrong. I like to just cultivate the curiosity. I think founders that can be curious and investors can be curious, but what we know is that people that concentrate on their day-to-day craft, day in, day out, but just at the margins, adjust. So if it looks like we're heading into a hardcore recession and the market's crashing, probably adjust your behavior and don't hire. And if you've got to fire quickly. But if there's all these green signs that we're actually in really fertile times, maybe you can dial it up a few percent. Maybe there's little risk in doing that. What people shouldn't do is wildly try and swing and predict with the market.
Yeah. Yeah, that great line from Adrian DeMarco, zoom out, look at the 10-year horizon. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there was another one. I forgot. I was thinking of Adrian because he's gone quite long China. But there was another chart I found of the number of disclosures from the Chinese government on financial performance. And it's recently fallen off the cliff. So either there's nothing to disclose and everything's good.
Or is it just like founders? You don't hear from them when they're talking kind of shit.
Anyway, so that's our episode.
What are we looking forward to, boys?
I'm just looking forward to, like, I've got a couple of days to actually get something done.
Like, yeah, after Southside.
After Southside and then trying to pull off an event, like, it takes a bit of effort.
And a cap raise.
And a cap raise. And on. Oh, I've got some property stuff on. And I've actually got some shit to do in the family office. I'm just looking forward to getting some stuff done.
Yeah, fair call.
I'm actually going to Melbourne this weekend with Anna. So she found some cheap tickets a few weeks ago. So off to Melbourne for the weekend.
Nice.
Nice.
Jack always waits to the end of the episode to do his flex.
Yeah. And I've actually got something planned on. So I was looking forward to it.
Oh, you're bringing your mates along. Is that it?
Nah. Don't get me started. It conflicts with St. Patrick's Day at the rugby club. So she wasn't happy when she put it on me. She said, what would you rather do? And I said, don't make me sad.
Jack, as long as you keep coming back to trust and respect.
Yeah, that's it.
Maren and I have a photo shoot. We won a wedding photographer was giving away a prize of a photo shoot.
Of course you did. Two beautiful people just going to bask in the glory of someone's fucking calendar. Oh, vomit.
So we're going up to the Glasshouse Mountains for some family photos.
Now, they're not just you and Maren.
Oh, not just me and Maren.
No, okay. All right. We've been talking about narcissists quite a bit recently, but I'm going to have to tap you on the shoulder. But if it's family photos,
we had our
family photos, and I was a bit skeptical, but I look at them fondly now.
Put a bet on the size of the shirt that Aaron's going to wear. We got XL, large, medium, small.
Which size of Maren's shirts?
Yeah. Sorry.
Oh. I did that again. Where was I? Oh, the Noosa event. The other shirt I had in the car was, again, Maren's tribe shirt. So
there's a common theme here, Aaron.
Yeah. I have nothing to add at that point.
Okay. All right. Let's wind it up for listeners. Look forward to seeing you next week. And please keep the feedback coming. I've really enjoyed running into people that actually listen to this rambling. So
always is.
All right.
Thanks, boys.
See you guys.
We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you're a sophisticated investor under Australian law, we'd welcome you to sign up to our investor syndicate, where we'll notify you of investment opportunities as they come up. If you're a B2B founder and think Tribe would be a fit for you, go to Get Capital page of our website. And whether you're a founder or an investor, if you're looking to take your early stage investing or company to the next level in 2024, consider joining one of our offsites or US and UK market entry missions occurring in February, March, May, June, August, and November.